Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's often said that how you view a given political issue depends on how close to the issue you are. Journalist Helen Thorpe, my guest today, has helped Americans gain a better understanding of some of our contemporary social justice issues through her intimate, thorough portraits of people experiencing life as a dreamer, a woman serving in combat in the military, or a newly arrived political refugee. At a time when America is debating on whether to accept more or less political or humanitarian refugees, her new book, The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom, follows 22 newly arrived teenagers from around the world through their first year in an English language acquisition class in Denver, Colorado. Classroom just like countless others in every American city. They come from Mexico or Central America, the Congo, Burma, and Iraq, to name just a few. They speak 14 different languages and speak little to no English on arrival. But through the course of the year and the book, we learn about their lives, their remarkable resilience in adjusting, as well as the difficult and often tragic stories on how they arrived in the U.S. It offers a new view to the political refugee debates. Helen Thorpe is a journalist who formerly wrote for The New Yorker, Texas Monthly, and The New York Times Magazine. Her earlier books, Just Like Us from 2009, documented four Mexico teenage girls who are now what we call dreamers, and Soldier Girls in 2014 documented three women who served multiple tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. Her latest book, The Newcomers, is published by Scribner's. Helen Thorpe, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, for your latest book, you decided to take a very novel approach of looking at the refugee crisis and how refugees adapt here in the United States. You decided to follow a classroom of newly arrived immigrants through a school, through a year. What led you to do that?
I spent a year inside an English language acquisition classroom where I was watching these newly arrived kids learn English and kind of figure out America and try to get to know one another all at the same time. I knew that South High School in Denver had particular expertise working with refugee students and refugee families. And I went there initially just to sort of see what I could learn and try to figure out if there was some way to write about the refugee crisis in a way that would show how it intersected with my community or a community here in America. And I just found the experience of watching the kids over the course of that year completely fascinating, because at the outset, they couldn't talk to one another. They couldn't talk to me, and they couldn't talk to their teacher. They couldn't understand anything I said to them. And I was just wondering, like, how does this teacher even convey English to 22 kids who speak 14 different languages? Like, how will that even work? But then watching the kids try to talk to one another through Google Translate, the apps on their phones and things like that became really fascinating for me. And then, of course, they ended up learning English so rapidly that by the end of the year, they were having full-blown friendships and crushes and sleepovers and all the stuff that you would expect teenagers to be doing.
Were you surprised at how quickly they adapted to life in the United States?
I thought it was astonishing. So there were two boys in the room, Solomon and Methuselah, who came from the Democratic Republic of Congo originally, and that's the country that sent the largest numbers of refugees to the U.S. in recent years. They arrived, and a year and a half after they first came to the U.S., they transitioned into mainstream classes and were reading To Kill a Mockingbird. So it was just astonishing to see kids go from beginner-level English acquisition to Kill a Mockingbird in a year and a half.
That's pretty amazing. You mentioned that year that was the largest influx of refugees from the Democratic Republic of Congo. That probably would surprise a lot of people. Were there a lot of surprises about who gets in as you began learning more about the refugee situation?
Very much so. I think we have a debate about the refugee crisis, but it doesn't actually reflect reality very well. You know, the debate suggests that we're talking almost exclusively about Muslim refugees. But when you look at who comes to this country, 2/3 of the people arriving are not from the Middle East. You know, they're from Africa, Asia, a lot of other places. So the debate currently is focused on a very narrow spectrum. And when you look at who refugees actually are, they're from all over the world. The Congo's been producing the largest number of refugees because they have an ongoing situation there that's the site of the United Nations' largest peacekeeping mission. They've got a lot of militia groups creating havoc and chaos and committing atrocities on the eastern side of the country. And we just don't spend a lot of time talking about that. But the reality is that's the country sending us the most refugees today. And they're largely Catholic, that country.
And Solomon and Methuselah, were they actually from Goma, the area where a lot of the conflict was taking place, or was that another student?
They were from the area right around Goma. They were from a village just to the north of the city of Goma. And ultimately, I traveled to the Congo and visited Goma to try to understand more about what their lives were like there and why they had to leave in the first place. That was incredibly illuminating. And I traveled there with some instructors from the Air Force Academy who were researching demilitarization, and they had planned a trip already and allowed me to tag along with them, which was fabulous for me because I very much wanted to see what the boys had left behind, but I would have not felt safe going on my own. So getting to go with them was great.
What did you find when you got there?
You know, they were interviewing a lot of United Nations officials and other people working with militia groups, trying to persuade them to give up their weapons. And I think because I was traveling with them, I had access to interviews. I don't think as a journalist that people would have necessarily spoken to me, you know, with the kind of candor and frankness that I was seeing. And I learned a great deal about the very entrenched violence on that side of the Congo and how difficult it is to, you know, once these militia groups have taken up weapons and are just pilfering and robbing and pillaging for food and anything else they need, how hard it is to persuade those people to put down their guns and go back to work and actually farm and grow their own food. And I could see why it's an incredibly difficult situation to resolve. I also came to understand just how traumatic life can be as a teenager. I came across some research about teenagers in that part of the Congo, and 9 out of 10 kids Solomon and Methuselah's age in that side of the Congo have witnessed traumatic things. 2/3 of them have seen somebody killed in front of their eyes. 1/3 of them have witnessed the act of rape. 1/5 have been abducted themselves. So really, really, really difficult experiences that the families are running away from. And you can well understand, you know, as a parent, why you would want to get your kid out of harm's way to a safe country.
And I would imagine there's a good percentage of those that are impressed into those militias.
Right. And
as child warriors.
The family, Solomon and Methuselah's family, was just, they were such a strong family. The parents were so admirable. They had raised such polite, good-mannered, hardworking kids. You couldn't find a better family anywhere, I don't think. I was incredibly impressed with the parents and the siblings who were working to help support the family. The entire family was just taking advantage of the opportunity to resettle here at a pace, you know, that was extraordinary. 3 months after they arrived in the U.S., they were economically self-sufficient with several family members working, 3 income streams. It's extraordinary to see what the families can do once they're given a safe home.
I was going to ask about the support networks. The kids had varying degrees of support networks when they came to the United States. They were mostly, the families were on their own, but some had better support underneath them. I think the refugees from the Congo had at least some support in helping them get started. Is that the case for most refugees or only for some?
So all refugees admitted to the United States with that categorization are aided by a resettlement agency. And so all refugees would have a caseworker assigned to them. I kind of describe in detail that relationship in one chapter where you're seeing the caseworker visit the Congolese family and how he's helping them. I didn't go into detail with other families, but they all had that kind of support. And the goal for the resettlement agencies is to make sure 90 days after arrival, the families are working, that they're not taking public subsidies, that, you know, that their kids are thriving in school. And it's just incredible to see the pace at which they get up and running here. You know, the trick for a resettlement agency is finding jobs for the adults in the family when the adults generally arrive with no English and sometimes not a lot of skills. So like in the case of Solomon and Methuselah's father or their older brothers, they had done a lot of farming, but they were now in an urban environment. So the resettlement agency found the older brother's jobs working as housemen in hotels, cleaning the public areas. And their dad got a job working as a dishwasher. And those are jobs where you can do the work without needing a lot of English. Other families, you know, I saw were sometimes working as maids in laundries or in meatpacking plants as well.
Now, I would think for a lot of those families where the family units are intact, they're putting high hopes on the children. The children are going to, they're going to learn English. They're going to get much better jobs. Was that the case? But what I
Absolutely.
Found was what I found was that some families were very much intact. Others were very much in crisis within themselves when they arrive.
Right. The fact that the Congolese family arrived with both parents and you know, all of the children, and that they had managed to stay intact through all the difficulties that they were encountering definitely worked to their advantage. The fact that there were, you know, multiple family members who were able to work helped them out a lot. In the case of an Iraqi family that I got to know, there was a single mom with three children. So you can see that's a harder situation. She's on her own. She's trying to support all three kids just by herself, one income stream. Much tougher for her, both psychologically because she's more isolated and more lonely, and just economically. And then, you know, there also are occasionally kids who arrive completely on their own, having lost both parents. There was an extraordinary young man that I met from Eritrea, another country in Africa. He arrived after having spent many years in a particular refugee camp geared to orphans. His mom had been killed and he had been separated from his father. So he got the chance to resettle here in the U.S. where he was being raised by a foster family. And, you know, I met him at age 17. He had befriended some of the students in the room that I was observing, and he was kind of serving as like their guide or mentor. And when I asked to interview two students from Eritrea in this classroom, they turned to him for advice. He came to me and said, "Tell me about this book that you're writing," you know, really like an adult would. And I was really awed by him, and I just asked him a little bit about his journey, and he started explaining, and then he said, "You know, why don't you come visit our church? I'm a deacon there." And I'm, you know, he's a 17-year-old kid in high school, but he's so adult-like from many years of being on his own. But he was just this extraordinarily generous soul who went around their high school befriending anybody from his home country or anybody who spoke his home language to try to make sure, you know, that they had a community. And he was always doing that. He said he saw it as his job to make sure nobody was left out or excluded. Really extraordinary young people.
My guest today is Helen Thorpe, a writer and journalist. Her latest book is titled The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom, as she followed the English immersion class at South High School in Denver for a year, the year of 2015-2016. And watched this class, which actually started with just a few students and grew through the year. And this incredible teacher who was helping them learn English and sort of assessing where they are in their learning so they could be assigned to a class once they got at least the rudiments of English, Eddie Williams. And what was really interesting is you learned all these stories, but in the first few weeks you had to be discouraged because nobody was speaking in the class, right?
I was sitting there with my notebook and there was almost nothing to write down because the kids were saying nothing. And I didn't understand at that moment. I came to understand later that that's actually, there's a technical phrase for this, you know, for people who study language acquisition call this the silent phase or pre-production. Before they can produce English, they're listening and their brains are just furiously absorbing everything the teacher's saying and all the English that they hear throughout their school day. And, you know, several months later, they will begin to produce kind of broken sentences. And then later their sentences will become more and more grammatically correct. But at the outset, for the life of them, they can't manage to speak English. And yet, nonetheless, they're actually learning it. It's just not evident. In those early weeks when the kids are saying nothing, I thought, there's no way I can write a book about this classroom because there's no dialogue. Like, how can I show the reader who these kids are when they're not speaking? but they slowly began to open up, and I just stayed in the room. I've worked with the same editor at Scribner for all three books that I've written, and I was phoning him and saying, I don't know if I can do this. And he just said, this sounds like a fascinating place. Why don't you just stay? Let's see what happens. And you know, he really encouraged me to take the time and wait. And the amazing thing was then to watch the extent to which the kids, you know, blossomed into these happy young teenagers, you know, interacting all the time later in the year. In fact, interacting so much that by the end of the year, the teacher was having a hard time corralling all the energy in his room. It was like the opposite scenario.
Well, the teacher sounds really amazing. Eddie Williams, who basically comes in and, I mean, he's starting with, here's how to say your name. I'm from whatever country I'm from. And slowly but surely, not only teaching these kids English, but also assessing where they are as far as their learning.
Yeah, and he's an incredibly gifted teacher. He has an interesting background. His mom is Latina. His dad is Anglo. His mom had grown up in a Spanish-speaking household herself. And when she went to school, she was a Spanish speaker placed into English language acquisition classes. And back in that time frame, she was really shamed and made to feel bad about herself because she spoke Spanish. And she was, you know, really criticized. And she kind of conveyed that to her son. And when he became a teacher himself, that was the number one thing on his mind. He didn't want to make any of his students feel badly about their heritage or feel badly that they didn't speak English yet. So he went to great lengths as he was teaching these kids to just always praise the things that they were doing right and just kind of ignore the mistakes that they were making or correct them very gently, because he didn't want to make them clam up again. So he was just always telling them, oh, that's really good that you said this. And if they say the wrong thing, he would just very gently offer an alternative phrasing that would be more correct.
Yeah.
He was also really good at just knowing what each kid needed in order to learn.
Now, you mentioned the two kid brothers from the Congo who really
right.
adjusted well. A more yeah. difficult adjustment came from Jacqueline and Miriam from Iraq. Actually,
right.
at first it was thought they were maybe from Syria, because these two young ladies had not only experienced a trauma of Syria, but actually they're from Iraq, and they'd actually left Iraq and moved to Syria as refugees there at one point.
Yeah, like tens of thousands of Iraqis, they sought safety first in Syria. And you know, so many Iraqis moved to Damascus where they were living. And initially that felt like a safe home. So their father had cooperated with the U.S. military after the invasion of Iraq, and he was targeted. So the family had to flee. They sought safety in Syria, but the civil war broke out. Their dad couldn't find work in Syria, went back to Iraq and vanished. He's presumed killed. So that's how their mom became a single mom with three children living in Damascus as the civil war there was unfolding. During the civil war, you know, the price of heating oil went up. They could no longer heat their home. The price of food skyrocketed. They had a really hard time affording anything other than potatoes, sometimes an eggplant, no meat. It became impossible to find work, and eventually they fled to Turkey. But in Turkey, they were asylum seekers without legal status, so their mom couldn't work legally there. And ultimately, only when they got to resettle in the United States did they stabilize and find a safe home. The girls had seen so much. They had lost their father while they were living in Syria. They ended up witnessing these horrific car bombings in their neighborhood that killed more than 100 of their neighbors, many people they knew. And they were pretty traumatized. And their mom, you know, I think had post-traumatic stress. She had anxiety and depression. And so they did have a rougher transition. I think the other thing that was hard for them was they arrived in 2015 just as the presidential election was getting underway. And there was a lot of criticism of Muslim refugees in the political rhetoric. And so they were feeling unwelcome here at the same time.
Now, Marion and her mother actually kept their head uncovered, but shortly after arriving, Jacqueline started wearing a hijab.
Yeah, she wore the headscarf and her sister did not, which when I was sitting in the classroom, I was thinking, what is this about? And I didn't know if they were Muslim, and I thought they were, but I wasn't sure. And ultimately, when I started visiting the family at home, their mom and I really connected over food, and I would bring Middle Eastern food to them, or they would make Middle Eastern food for me. We would often eat sitting on the floor, which was their traditional way of having a feast. And, you know, we would talk over these dinners, and their mom explained that she was Shia Muslim, but her husband had been Christian. And after they married, she began attending Christian services, and they had given their daughters Christian first names. Jacqueline and Mariam are both named for, Jacqueline is named for a saint, and Mariam is named for Mary, the mother of Jesus. And here in the U.S., the family was attending Arabic language Christian services at an evangelical church. So Jacqueline did identify as Muslim and wanted to wear the headscarf as a statement of her Muslim identity, but Mariam identified more as, you know, a believer in Jesus and Mary, and so the girls kind of diverged, one, you know, adopting one faith and one adopting the other. And their mom, you know, was always saying to them, Christianity and Islam are both good religions, and you can pick whichever one that you want. But she herself found it comforting to go to Christian services still, and that's where she sort of met most of her friends and people who were supporting her.
But that certainly made Jacqueline's life a little tougher, because she was encountering, you know, some really bad situations, say on the bus, riding to school.
Wearing the headscarf really is a marker. And as the rhetoric heated up around Muslim refugees, with assertions being made that they might commit acts of terror, which has never happened on U.S. soil, refugees vetted by the Department of Homeland Security have never been admitted to this country and then gone on to kill anyone here. But nonetheless, there was that idea being floated that that might happen. And she did encounter a lot of verbal abuse on the city buses, as did many of her classmates from South who also wore a headscarf. The headscarf became kind of the number one thing that was attracting a lot of this vitriol or hatred that they were running into during their commute.
You mentioned this occurred during the primary season, the school year occurred during the primary season leading up to the 2016 election. And all of a sudden, political refugees and refugees coming to this country become a central core issue pretty early. What was the reaction in that classroom to seeing themselves becoming an issue in the election?
You know, I think the students felt so misunderstood and misdescribed that it fueled their interest in talking to me. They ultimately, 21 of the 22 students told me that they wanted to participate in the book project and got permission from their parents to do so. They really wanted to tell their stories because they wanted to be understood. They wanted to be known and recognized. What they wanted to say was how glad they were to be admitted to the United States, how meaningful the opportunity was, how thankful they were to have a safe home. They wanted, you know, Americans to understand they felt no hostility towards anybody here. The following school year, I continued to spend time with the students all the way through the election, which took place during their second school year in the United States. The following school year after the election, there was such a unleashing of hatred upon anybody who looked foreign-born the week after the election, that it got very extreme, and the RTD bus system here in Denver even had to put plainclothes police officers on the buses taking kids to and from this high school, which has such a high concentration of foreign-born students, to protect the kids. And, you know, it was incredibly sad to see, because they're great kids. They're trying to do everything right. They just want to be in a classroom. They're trying to get good grades. They want to go to college, you know. As the teachers know, and, you know, if you read the book, as is very evident, they're completely by the book. They just want to do everything right. You know, they're trying so hard to put their best foot forward. It's a terrible misunderstanding to think that these kids or their families represent any kind of threat. In fact, generally, the people who are threatening are exactly who they've been running away from, and they have a real firsthand knowledge of terrorist groups in their home countries or militia groups who are causing great harm. It's the last thing on earth they want to be.
Now, through each of the school year, there were times where several students felt like they were going to fall through the cracks. But did any of the students actually sort of kind of fall through the cracks and drop out or obviously not adjust to life in the United States?
You know, there were moments in their first year where the teacher worried about one or another student. Jacqueline and Mariam in particular had a period of time where they felt depressed. They felt they weren't learning quickly. They thought English was incredibly hard. One thing that I learned that was surprising and interesting from spending a year in the room was how much easier it is for students who arrive if they speak a language that's close to English. Like students from El Salvador were coming, they spoke Spanish and English. 30% of the words are identical or nearly identical. The languages are so closely related. It was easier for those kids. With students like Jacqueline and Mariam who arrived speaking Arabic, there's far fewer words in common, but also Arabic, you know, it uses a different alphabet. It's written from right to left instead of left to right. The sentences are structured differently. They don't begin their sentences with a subject and then a verb. They start with the verb first. So I would say study Jacqueline and Mariam their schoolwork instead of Jacqueline and Mariam studied their schoolwork. Mm-hmm. I mean, just getting the words in the right order was challenging for them. And there were other kids in the room for whom it was similarly difficult because their languages were so far away, especially the kids from Burma, speaking languages like Karen or Kareni. So the teacher did worry in particular about some of the kids who were struggling very hard at certain moments. But by the end of the year, he had successfully managed through, you know, different interventions. For example, he found student mentors for everybody when he was worried about the kids coming to school and staying in class. And the mentors encouraged them in their home languages. So he found like a set of very high achieving Iraqi twins who were ahead of, you know, a couple years ahead at the high school to come mentor Jacqueline and Mariam. He found somebody who spoke the home language of every student in the room, amazingly, to mentor them. And he kept everybody on track. And by the end of the year, he had all of them learning successfully and everybody, you know, was ready to move on pretty quickly.
Now, this story takes place in Denver, but this is really being duplicated in every urban school district in the country, isn't it?
Yeah. And there are many places that have what they call a newcomer center, like this room, one that is specifically geared to welcoming kids from war-torn countries or kids whose schooling has been interrupted.
The name of the book is The Newcomers. Helen, thanks very much for joining us again.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Journalist Helen Thorpe's latest book is titled The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.